Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Black Friday is kicking off a race to the stores, and for Congress, it's the last day of rest before another kind of frenzy, the race to get the GOP tax bill passed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl, who's looking for great deals on a 4K TV right now. It is Friday, November 24th. Glad you could join us today. We're going to get to the economic implications of all that shopping that's happening this weekend a little later in the show. First, let's look back at the big economic stories of the week with Neela Richardson, chief economist at Redfin. Hi, Neela.
Hi, Molly.
Hi. So this is being described as a make or break week for the GOP tax plan. There was a Business Insider story this week that said it had gotten a triple whammy of bad reviews, cuts that would primarily benefit the rich. 50% of Americans will see tax increases by 2027. Economists agree it'll explode the debt and the deficit. What is up here?
And you know what's remarkable about all of those critiques is that many of them just fall right within the GOP, let alone what's happening, you know, outside the GOP with the Democrats and the American people. Right. So it's a once in a generation tax overhaul. And yet it's not living up to that right now. We still have many concerns about this tax plan. And part of the reason is it wasn't widely shared or shopped. This is something that has a self-imposed deadline. The Senate and the House want to get a GOP tax plan passed by the end of the year. And so there were no big studies. There was no PRing or marketing of this plan. It was a wholesale shift without any kind of sales pitch. And whenever you do that, when you're trying to make a big change, you do so at your own risk because you can't bring the American people along with you to the final plan.
Well, and it's ironic because the way that you have described that sounds like the way that Republicans for years described the Obamacare process. And now this tax bill would itself repeal the individual mandate and kind of come at Obamacare from a sort of a side door, right?
Right. One of the big things about the tax plan is it doesn't pay for itself. It adds $1.4 trillion less in revenue. It adds to the federal deficit. And they have to figure out ways to shrink those numbers to get more revenue in the door. And one way to do so is by attacking their least favorite Obama-era policy, which is Obamacare. Fewer people will be insured if the individual mandate is eliminated, and that helps pay for the tax cut. For a GOP senator or a House Republican, it might be a win-win, but there are some who disagree because it means that fewer people will have health insurance.
Right. And if they're feeling vulnerable, that's an easy place to get attacked. Here's an interesting tidbit from a New York Times article this week that came up yesterday on Thanksgiving. It says that at a Wall Street Journal conference, Gary Cohn asked the audience of CEOs how many of them would invest more if the tax cut were passed. Mm-hmm. And he said that only a few, this article notes, only a few attendees raised their hands. And he reportedly asked, why aren't the other hands up? Now, this is the central promise that if businesses get tax cuts, they'll invest this money. Economists have disagreed. Where do you fall on this?
You know, there's no way that the federal government, and it's not within this plan, can force companies to invest more in either infrastructure or human capital. That is not within the boundary lines of this tax policy. It does give corporations a tax cut, and then it says, do with it what you will. Well, we know that corporate profits have been high, and they still haven't, even though they have cash on hand, they haven't been investing and making those big capital investments. So what is it likely that they'll do? I mean, you don't have to be an economist to predict. They'll likely keep doing what they've been doing, which is to buy back shares and give dividends. Likely to continue if they receive this kind of tax cut.
Neela, we've got about 30, 40 seconds left. Let's pivot to Uber quickly. A story in the Wall Street Journal today reporting that new CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, was informed about this big data breach 2 weeks after he came into the position in September and then waited to inform consumers. How bad does this look for Uber?
You know, the ushering of a new CEO was supposed to bring in a clean slate, and that slate is now really, really muddy. It's not just a data breach. It was a cover-up and a payment to the hackers themselves, which makes you wonder about the future of Uber and the future of their ability to secure customer data. So it's not a great bit of news for Uber, and it means that the CEO, the new CEO, comes into that job with quite a bit of baggage.
Neela Richardson from Redfin, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
On Wall Street today, oil prices are up. The shoppers are out. Everybody feels great. All the details when we do the numbers. As Americans try to make the most of holiday shopping, the 10,000 or so residents of Rockport, Texas, are still dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. Many are still living in hotel rooms. Some had to relocate to rental properties miles away. Marketplace's Andy Euler went to Rockport to see how the storm has changed the local economy and put some holiday expectations on hold.
Didi Kylo and her husband walk out of a Walmart supercenter in Rockport, carrying bags full of Christmas ornaments and garland. She wasn't crazy about making this shopping trip. All the effects of the hurricane still linger.
I've been a Scrooge for several years, but this just made it worse.
The Kylos have four kids, so Didi says she wants to make the holiday season as normal as possible, even as their roof still has to be tarped. They're walking around on unfinished patchwork flooring. She says she's really conflicted about spending.
There's people with nothing. People are still living in tents. And I feel guilty buying stuff when there's people that don't even have a home right now.
Candace Corlett is president at WSL Strategic Retail. She says a disaster makes people reprioritize their purchases. Survivors are looking for deals on flooring and siding, but
it's also an opportunity to look for things that keep your family cozy. You know, you're looking to Black Friday for deals on those home repair, but the home repair things that come from the heart.
Andrew Robertson works at the Sears in Rockport. He says every day he sees folks shifting their priorities.
Some people come in and they're like, yeah, I don't have a house right now, or I'm living out of a temporary trailer right now. And so their needs are very different from the general people who are going in and getting stuff on Black Friday.
He says for many here, it's no longer just about cheap TVs and gaming consoles. It's about cutting any costs as they struggle to get their lives back to normal. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We are halfway through the Obamacare open enrollment period, and we've got a bit of a healthcare mystery on our hands. Earlier this week, federal health officials reported nearly 800,000 consumers selected plans on healthcare.gov. That is the federal website where people shop for plans. And it's the third consecutive week that enrollment has outpaced last year's numbers. More than 2 million people have picked plans so far. From our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at what could be driving the surge.
There's no easy explanation for the surge in signups.
I thought that the administration was going to be successful in all of the different efforts it's made to discourage people from signing up.
George Lowenstein is a professor of economics and psychology at Carnegie Mellon University. He says there are plenty of reasons that you'd expect enrollment to drop this year. The Trump administration cut the ACA advertising budget by 90%. It cut funding for navigators, the people who help consumers shop around, and healthcare.gov goes dark for a while most weekends. That's all happening, says Lowenstein, while premiums have spiked and fewer insurers are selling policies.
Almost for sure there has to be something interesting happening at a psychological level.
The most likely culprit? Maybe something called loss aversion. Robert Caldini, author of the book Influence, Science, and Practice, says you see loss aversion all the time, like when a cupcake chain shuts down.
And their signature cupcake that was going for about $4 immediately began getting offers of up to $250 a piece online.
Caldini's hunch is that Republicans' threat to repeal Obamacare is driving people to get coverage before it's too late. Another factor, says the University of Pittsburgh's Kate Lamberton, lots of us don't like to be told what to do. So the Trump administration pulling the ads is like Big Brother going away.
An interesting and I'm sure completely unintended consequence may be that some people didn't feel pushed into it. They didn't feel yelled at.
Ironically, this phenomenon was likely at play back when Obamacare first passed. Plenty of people resented the federal government telling them to buy insurance. Now that the law might go away, plenty of people resent the federal government for trying to take it from them. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The Trump administration may be trying to downplay Obamacare, but it has had a lot to say about global trade deals and putting American business first. Earlier this year, the U.S. Commerce Department found that companies in seven countries were selling a certain kind of steel wire in the U.S. at an unfairly low price. If the International Trade Commission agrees, the U.S. could start taxing those imports. And there are other investigations into import pricing in the works. But some American businesses say that a crackdown could actually hurt them. Alex Olgan of WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, reports.
At Marmac, a steel wire manufacturer in the small town of Macbee, South Carolina, robotic arms coil steel wire into a roll that's 4.5 inches in diameter. It is then dropped onto a conveyor belt where workers pick up the wire and package it into boxes. John Martin owns Marmac. He says this rebar tie wire is the core of his business.
So anytime you build a bridge, a dam, you may very well be using our rebar tie wire.
On this day, about two-thirds of the raw steel the plant uses to manufacture its products is from U.S. steel mills. The rest was imported at a lower cost. Some of the steel Martin uses comes from places the Commerce Department found were importing at an unfairly low cost. Martin worries if President Trump weighs in on a separate trade decision, it could hurt his business.
If all of a sudden there are tariffs on our raw material, we know that prices will go up, but we really don't know what all the results will be.
That's because the president could do a variety of things under a trade law that allows him to designate cheap steel imports as a threat to the country's national security. That's only been used twice since the 1980s. Martin just isn't sure what to expect.
Businessmen thrive on predictability.
John Ferriola also wants to know what future steel prices will look like. He's the CEO of Nucor Corporation, one of the largest steel producers in the country. He wants the president to take action, though he won't specify whether he would back tariffs on foreign steel. He says he wants the president to do something to, quote, meaningfully adjust imports.
We are not asking for protection. I just go crazy when I hear people say that the steel industry is asking for protection. What we want is a level playing field.
Based on what Trump said earlier this year, Ferriola was hoping there would have been some action by now. Nucor has a few connections to the White House. Its former CEO was an advisor to Trump, and Ferriola was on the president's manufacturing council before it was disbanded. Ferriola is concerned about the 20% increase since last year of steel imports to the U.S., sold by his foreign competitors.
But they've been shipping in, and as this continues to get delayed, they continue to surge. And it's reached a critical point now.
While manufacturers like Marmac see foreign imports as a way to keep prices competitive, Nucor has filed numerous petitions with the Commerce Department and International Trade Commission to counteract what it sees as unfair trade practices.
So we call it whack-a-mole. You know, you finally beat one down, another one pops up, and it's just an endless process.
But if the government imposes tariffs on imported steel, it could lead to similar requests from manufacturers who use steel in their products. That's according to trade economist Chad Bown with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
They could be the next industries that come forward and say, hey, I want to file my own global safeguard case or my own anti-dumping case to stop imports from coming in the products that I make and have to compete in the American market for.
No matter what happens, it will have a big effect on the American economy. The American Iron and Steel Institute says the industry supports more than 140,000 U.S. jobs. In Charlotte, I'm Alex Olgan for Marketplace.
coming up.
It's funny to think that once upon a time, the Big Apple became very close to being called possibly the Big Orange.
The secret life of orange. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 31 points, a tenth percent, to close at 23,557. The NASDAQ was up 21 points, 0.3%. It finished at 6,889. And the S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.2%, to end at 2,602. For the week, the Dow grew 0.8%. The NASDAQ added 1.5%. And the S&P 500 picked up 0.9%. No discount on retail stocks this Black Friday. Macy's floated up 0.2%. The company's CEO said holiday sales were off to a strong start. No surprise, online retailer Amazon also strengthened 2.5%. CBS rose 0.5%. The broadcaster sorted out a dispute over fees with the Dish Network. Dish slammed down 0.1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. You're listening to Marketplace. Black Friday may have kicked off as an American phenomenon, but increasingly, it belongs to the world. Globalization and technology have made it a lot easier for overseas consumers to buy American goods. The practice of cross-border commerce has been around for decades, but today it's getting a big boost. Marketplace's Jed Kim has more.
Did you get a ridiculously enormous flat-screen TV for Black Friday? You know who else did? A whole lot of people in Korea. Eric Cho is the director of business development for Makeshop. His company helps Korean consumers buy items from the U.S. The buyers order the goods online, get them sent to Cho's company, which then checks the merchandise and sends it on to them.
For the most part, Korean consumers don't shop on their holidays. They go and visit family, right? But they know Memorial Day, July 4th, Labor Day. I mean, they know all of these big sales are going to be coming and they're ready for the shopping.
Cho says even with tariffs, this can help Koreans spend less than buying in their brick-and-mortar stores. This month and next make up about 40% of his company's shipping for the year, which, by the way,
we're probably on schedule to move somewhere between $350 and $500 million worth of product.
There's a lot more to be made, especially in sales to bigger players in the region. Lily Verone is with Forrester Research.
The main axes of trade for the next 5 years are actually between China and the U.S.
Exports from North America to Asian Pacific countries will top $53 billion this year. Cross-border e-commerce is a small portion of retail sales, but it's growing quickly. And besides,
it's more than the value of the overall sales. It's actually the insights and the data that you can get to inform your broader globalization strategy.
It helps companies put a toe in the waters of markets they may want to plunge into later. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
A little more on shopping, since it is in the zeitgeist. Black Friday and Cyber Monday are some of the biggest shopping days of the year, and they officially kick off the holiday season, where, by the way, consumers will spend an expected $630 billion this year. That stat is from a holiday shopping survey conducted by PayPal. I spoke with PayPal's president, Dan Schulman, to ask what we could expect from this year's season.
Well, I think what retailers are increasingly seeing is that more and more Americans are shopping on their mobile phone. The statistics that are anticipated this year is that 80% of Americans will shop on their mobile phones over the holiday season.
But online shopping overall is still a relatively small number of overall retail sales. Right. I mean, and I read a Morning Consult poll that said that most people actually, by a small majority, still do want to shop in stores, even millennials. So when you look at the sort of e-commerce landscape, what do you think the future really is of Cyber Monday versus Black Friday?
Yeah. Today in the U.S., somewhere between 10 and 12% of overall sales are done online and mobile. But if you look at countries like China, you can have as much as 70% of all commerce done through the mobile phone. In fact, in many ways, the United States is a laggard in digital payments. So as I look forward, I think you're going to see more and more payments move towards digital. For instance, today, if you order ahead online and go to a restaurant, skip the line and pick up that sandwich, and then you just walk out because you've already paid for that online. Was that an online transaction or an offline transaction? In fact, it was a little bit of both. And I think what you're going to see is that mobile is going to blur and even eliminate the distinction between what we think of today as two separate things, online and in-store shopping. They'll actually become one in the same.
Let's talk about the payments landscape overall. You obviously, PayPal had great third quarter numbers. Venmo's becoming a bigger part of the business. But there is a lot of competition brewing. Everyone seems to have woken up to payments, including Apple and Alphabet, among, I assume, Amazon must be looming. What do you think when you look around that competitive landscape?
I think that this is a market that is exploding. The online mobile payments marketplace today is about $3 trillion around the world. In the next 3 years, by the end of 2020, that's expected to go over $8 trillion. And so this is an exploding marketplace. There will be no one winner in this. It is one in which many players will succeed. We have a number of competitive advantages. And I think as long as we continue to focus on what consumers and merchants need and not anything else, I think we'll remain a market leader in this.
Don't spoil anything necessarily, but what are you going to be shopping for? What are some of the hot ticket items?
Well, one of the things for sure that I'll be doing is using PayPal to donate to different causes. I think one of the more uplifting statistics that came out of our study was that 53% of all people we surveyed said that they will make an online donation this year, and 44% of Americans said they plan to donate this year during Giving Tuesday.
That actually sounds like the best hot ticket item I can think of. Dan Schulman is president of PayPal. Thank you so much for the time.
Molly, thank you so much.
You're probably aware that holidays have color schemes. It's just a useful branding tool for marketing folks. Take orange, for example. That is a Thanksgiving color through and through. But also, if you're in Europe, it feels very Dutch. Here's Cassia St. Clair, author of The Secret Lives of Color, with why that is.
Well, originally, the color orange didn't have its own name. It was, in fact, just called yellow red or giallo red in sort of very early English. As the name of the colour became associated with the fruit, it became this kind of exotic branding opportunity really for a hugely influential and popular family in European history, the House of Orange, which ruled the Netherlands for a very long time. Their descendants are still the monarchs of the Netherlands. Orange has just become so associated with this particular family and with the Dutch people, and is so used to celebrate them and has been for centuries. It's funny to think that once upon a time, the Big Apple became very close to being called possibly the Big Orange. New York was actually captured by the Dutch army on July 20th, 1673. They promptly, as proud Dutchmen, renamed the city New Orange. It may well have held this name for time immemorial, were it not that the Dutch were fighting several other battles on several other fronts, and so rather ran out of steam. Just under 12 months later, New Orange was returned to the British, who renamed it once more, and so New Orange went back to being New York.
That was the latest in our occasional series on the sometimes surprising business and economic backstories of colors. We've got more of them coming up over the next few weeks. And this final note before we go, you heard us mention CBS and Dish earlier in the broadcast. 4 million Dish Network subscribers now have access to CBS again. The network was blacked out in 18 cities after CBS asked for a huge increase in how much Dish should pay to carry its shows. The two sides finally made a deal late last night, restoring access to customers all over America, including several California cities, like Los Angeles, where customers would have loved to watch the San Diego Chargers beat the Dallas Cowboys in the big Thanksgiving game. But the deal only happened after the football game was over. And that is tough turkey. All right, time for us to rock out of here. Today, the Dow rose 31 points, a 10th percent. The NASDAQ was up 21 points, 3/10 percent. And the S&P 500 gained 5 points. That was 2/10 of a percent. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I am Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl will be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.